welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are glad that you are with us today. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in the second half of our show today, our veteran news director Dave Thompson and I will chat about this week's news here in the state. Dave will tell us whether he thinks the North Dakota legislature is any closer to providing true property tax reform. Also, our one-of-a-kind movie reviewer Matt Olean will stop by the Main Street studio, and he'll review Mickey 17. It gives a whole new meaning to what expendable can mean. And we begin Main Street today with the news that a Morton County jury on Wednesday ordered Greenpeace to pay hundreds of millions of dollars to Energy Transfer, the developer of the Dakota Access Pipeline, after finding that the environmental group incited illegal behavior by anti-pipeline protesters and defamed the company. The nine-person jury awarded over $660 million in damages, with Greenpeace USA responsible for more than $400 million. Energy Transfer accused Greenpeace of supplying resources and spreading misinformation to damage its reputation. While Greenpeace denied the allegations, maintaining that the protests were indigenous-led. The verdict, delivered after a three-week trial in Mandan, has drawn sharp reactions from free speech and environmental advocates, as well as indigenous activists who argue that the lawsuit was meant to punish activism. Greenpeace has not confirmed whether it will appeal other legal battles related to the pipeline, including suits involving the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, remain ongoing. Joining me now to unpack this blockbuster trial really is Mary Stoyer. She's a reporter based in Bismarck with the North Dakota Monitor. Mary, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you.
Mary, you've been covering this since essentially day one. Give us first why this complaint was brought.
So Energy Transfer filed suit against Greenpeace for alleged physical harms to the Dakota Access Pipeline during the protests back in 2016 and 2017, as well as defamation and a few other claims. So their argument was that Greenpeace essentially sent supplies, provided training and information for protesters in order to intentionally cause millions of dollars of damage against Energy Transfer, as well as undermine their ability to finance the pipeline project with a loan. Energy Transfer says this was all illegal and that they deserve compensation for it.
Mary, from what you saw in court, how much of this case was about legal liability versus an effort to discourage activism, and especially in this case, environmental activism?
I really can't speak to that, but I will say I've heard both arguments. Energy Transfer, of course, says that Greenpeace needs to be held accountable for what it says was an intentional effort to hurt the company and stop the pipeline. Greenpeace says that all of the claims are false and that it's just being made into a scapegoat in order to hurt environmental and free speech movements going forward.
The dollars at play here are just substantial. Mary, what was the atmosphere like inside the courtroom?
So yesterday, after the verdict was rendered, it was pretty quiet. Everyone sort of egressed in front, out of the building and right outside the courthouse. And most of the people sitting in the audience, I think, were either Greenpeace staff or Greenpeace supporters. So as soon as everyone got outside, there was sort of an immediate air of disappointment. There was a lot of There are a lot of heavy hearts, I would say. Energy Transfer's attorneys, of course, were happy and said justice had been served.
Did the verdict surprise you as someone who was there the entire length of the trial?
I hope I don't sound like I'm dodging the question, but I honestly think I would have been surprised no matter what happened. I really didn't know how the case was going to go. So I even thought to myself that morning before the verdict came out, like, you know, I think I'm going to be shocked no matter what the jury decides.
During the trial, Greenpeace's former leader, Annie Leonard, testified that the group only got involved after being asked by Standing Rock leaders. How do you think, Mary, her testimony shape the narrative of Greenpeace's involvement?
So I think that throughout the trial, Greenpeace was attempting to demonstrate to the jury that not only Greenpeace employees and former employees, but also Standing Rock itself and other Native activists who came to the protest to support the cause, that it was the indigenous communities that were getting involved and not Greenpeace that were taking the lead. So I think Greenpeace wanted to demonstrate through her testimony that that was true and that Greenpeace has a policy of just coming in to help Native causes explicitly when they're asked. I can't speak for the response from the jury, but I do think that was the message that they were trying to get across.
Mary, one of the most dramatic moments you wrote about in court was when Energy Transfer's lawyer compared the Dakota Access protests to Rosa Parks' defiance on a bus in Montgomery, Alabama. How did that exchange play out, and what kind of reaction did you feel that it received?
The jury was really straight-faced the entire time. I do think that that was one of the most maybe animated back and forth moments in the case. You know, the attorney has always been throughout the trial very quick with his questions, but Annie Leonard's responses were also very prompt. You know, they really had a banter. And so, of course, that caught my attention. And I think the people who I was sitting with were also very interested in that part of her testimony and where it went. But again, like the jury, they were really good at maintaining a poker face. And given the verdict, I can only speculate as to how they felt about that. Yeah, I really don't know.
And there was a movement before the trial began, Mary, to relocate this trial. Bring us up to speed on why that occurred.
Yeah, so throughout the case, at least a few times, Greenpeace has requested that the case be moved to somewhere else in North Dakota. So they say that because of Morton County's voting track record, perhaps the number of people who have ties to the energy industry, as well as their proximity to the protests in 2016 and 2017, that led them to argue that a Morton County jury could not render a fair verdict. And so they filed court documents laying out those arguments, and the judge at the time of those requests basically said, these arguments aren't convincing at this time. I'm not going to move it. Let's see what happens. And so that could very well be something that Greenpeace brings up again in appeal. Their previous efforts weren't successful, but now I suppose that they could bring that up when they're trying to make the case to the Supreme Court that they want to have the verdict overturned.
We're enjoying our conversation with Mary Stoyer. She's a reporter for the North Dakota Monitor, and she's based in Bismarck. Wednesday, a Morton County jury ordered Greenpeace to pay hundreds of millions of dollars to Energy Transfer, the developer of the Dakota Access Pipeline. Mary, during the trial, Greenpeace witnesses admitted that the organization provided lockboxes to the protest camps. First, what are they? And then next, they didn't argue that they instructed protesters how to use them. And I'm curious how Energy Transfer then tried to link Greenpeace acts of obstruction or vandalism to those lockboxes.
My explanation is going to be very non-technical. So lockboxes are essentially these devices. They can be crafted out of a few different materials, is my understanding, that protesters use to either attach themselves to one another to form sort of a blockade, or there were pictures presented to the jury during the trial of protesters using them to fasten themselves to equipment. And the idea is that it's sort of challenging to remove them. So if they are locked in place somewhere, construction on the pipeline perhaps could not proceed. So Greenpeace witnesses said in a few different instances that they brought lockboxes to the protest camps. I heard it said a couple different times that they say they were asked to provide them, but everyone on the witness stand or who spoke via video deposition said that Greenpeace never told anyone to use them. And so that they can't say one way or another whether or not they were actually used during the protests. So Energy Transfer tried to sort of connect the dots that this was evidence that Greenpeace had aided and abetted trespass and other forms of obstruction of construction of the pipeline during the protests. But kind of a response that Greenpeace had is like, well, you're not presenting any evidence proving that Greenpeace was the one who caused any one protester to engage in this tactic.
Mary, the jury took more than a day, almost 2.5 days, to reach a verdict. Did that surprise anyone? And as the time wore on, what was the feeling like as the jury was yet to render their decision or their verdict?
It was such a long case that I certainly didn't know what to expect as far as how long they would take. I think everyone was just sort of sitting around. You know, I would talk to other people, other reporters, and we would all say that we were watching our phones very closely, thinking every message was going to be news that a verdict would be rendered. As far as what the attorneys were thinking, I wasn't in touch with them, so I don't know.
How did you learn that a verdict was imminent?
Oh, someone texted me. I suppose the attorneys probably learned first, and then that was sort of circulated among some of the observers and people in the gallery who wanted to know as soon as the news was coming out. But we got a little bit of a heads up. We had time to get to the courtroom and sit there and wait to make sure we saw it in person.
During the trial, Energy Transfer claimed that Greenpeace's actions cost them millions of dollars. A couple questions about that. Did Greenpeace challenge those financial claims? Because they mounted obviously to tens and hundreds of millions of dollars, talking about delays, security costs, lost revenue. Or was it kind of agreed upon these were the damages, or were those debated also in court?
No, they were very contested. So this was another area where Greenpeace's counsel said, we're getting these numbers, you're not providing any evidence that Greenpeace is responsible for this. And they also said that Energy Transfer did not provide any proof to the notion that any other organization involved in the protests weren't also responsible for these damages. To put it a different way, they were saying that you might be arguing Greenpeace is a cause, but you're not providing any explanation as to what any other potential causes involvements could have been. I know that's sort of confusing, but that was a huge point of argument in the case, that Greenpeace was basically saying, you're making a logical leap here and you're not fairly connecting the dots for the jury, proving that we did this.
Throughout the trial, Mary, Greenpeace argued that this trial is only really here because it's a way to silence environmental activism. Have you seen any signs that this case could set a precedent for how activist groups engage in large-scale protests in the future? And what did Energy Transfer have to say about that, that this was not about silencing environmental activism?
I think I've heard that said by Greenpeace as well as some advocates who were observing the jury. I don't know that I have expertise to speak to whether or not there's evidence that this could set precedent or necessarily what to look out for, but it's certainly something that is being said. Energy Transfer, I think, calls this an excuse for Greenpeace to try to perhaps avoid responsibility and try to, you know, I think they accused of Greenpeace of twisting Energy Transfer's intentions. They basically say, no, you're misunderstanding the point of why we're bringing this suit, which they claim is entirely legitimate and sincerely an attempt to recoup damages resulting from the protests.
This trial lasted a month, and you saw many former and current Greenpeace employees and activists testify. Mary, what was your general feeling listening to these employees from Greenpeace talking about this trial?
I was not a reporter in North Dakota in 2016 and 2017. And so I appreciated hearing their perspective of what was happening on the ground because, you know, all I know of the protests is what happened after the fact. And so I've spent many hours in court, not just in this lawsuit, but in other lawsuits, learning about what the protests were like and sort of stitching together all of these different narratives about it. And so I am grateful for every new perspective that I get to hear because it was such a complicated event that there are so many different stories to be told about what it was like.
Mary, both sides, I think, have pointed fingers at the media's role in shaping public opinion on the pipeline protest. As a journalist covering the case, how do you navigate reporting on something so politically charged? And I'll note that you were maybe the only news reporter that attended the trial from start to finish.
As a reporter covering the lawsuits, it is a little bit easier in some ways that I can reference some of the court documents. I don't have to be in the field on the ground where sometimes things can get more chaotic. I can point to what was said in court, although there are also challenges to that. I think I try my best to just reach out to everyone and know that if they take issue with anything I report, that they can get in touch and we can have a conversation. Sometimes all you can do is just try to stay faithful to what was said in the hearings and remember to try to include all the other context you can just because there's so much history here. But I don't know. I guess I don't do anything necessarily different, although there is more pressure than usual just because the stakes are so high.
Yeah, Mary, and I hope that because of that, that there wasn't any unnecessary pressure placed on you. Did you have anyone reach out to you during the trial, Mary, and question your reporting?
Honestly, no, not really. I think people were generally very nice to me. So even though, you know, it was a long haul and there is kind of that, like, I was certainly nervous being someone who was providing daily coverage of it, but I never had anyone from the outside sending me mean messages or anything like that, thankfully.
That's good to know. Mary, there are other legal battles still related to the pipeline, including suits involving the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. Those remain. Can you bring us up to date about those suits?
Yes. So North Dakota's lawsuit against the Army Corps of Engineers went to trial about a year ago, and they want $38 million for what they say were damages sustained related to the protests due to the federal agency's negligence responding and managing the situation. So an order on that case still hasn't been released. That's something we're certainly keeping a close eye on. And then the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe also filed suit against the Army Corps of Engineers. They had done so previously in 2016, but this is a new lawsuit filed in October. And this is another complicated situation, but the pipeline is operating without an easement to cross underneath the Missouri River under Lake Oahe. The easement was revoked due to a series of legal twists and turns, and the Army Corps has not made a decision yet whether or not to grant it. And so Standing Rock essentially says this pipeline shouldn't be operating and you're violating the law by continuing to allow it to operate, despite that a final decision on that easement has not been made. And so they want a federal judge to order that the pipeline be shut down.
Mary, as we wrap up our conversation today, you've had about 24 hours now to digest this trial and its verdict. What do you take away from this process, the verdict, and maybe moving forward? What have you thought about, Mary?
I think it's still really early because it is such a massive decision. I'm still doing a lot of digesting. I think the immediate steps going forward, what I heard from the judge yesterday after the verdict came out, is that the attorneys will still have a lot more conferring to do to kind of go over the verdict and make sure everything looks in order. And there might be some other sort of housekeeping stuff that they have to do. And again, I'm an attorney, so I don't know, but the judge basically said there's still a lot more work to do after the verdict to sort out what happens. So I think I'll probably be doing a lot of the processing, watching those meetings, hopefully. And I certainly am going to be talking to people about what they think, but my immediate reactions, I think, are still, I'm still digesting them for sure.
And as we do finally wrap it up, Mary, what led into the decision to dedicate you from a small North Dakota Monitor group of reporters all of the resources then that you had to give to this trial? Was that a hard decision for your organization?
I don't know. I think we were sort of taking it day by day. We didn't know what we were going to see in the hearings and what was going to be going on at the same time in the legislature. So I knew that I might have to be pulled aside to watch other things as they happened. I was watching this lawsuit starting, I think, around last summer. So I had already been keeping an eye on it, and I love covering the courts. I had definitely pled to my editor, Amy, that I really wanted to spend as much time in the courtroom as I could. As far as everything else, you know, I don't know. It just sort of happens.
Mary Stoyer is a reporter for the North Dakota Monitor. She's based in Bismarck, and she reported first that a Morton County jury on Wednesday has ordered Greenpeace to pay hundreds of millions of dollars to Energy Transfer, the developer of the Dakota Access Pipeline, after being at the trial that lasted for 3.5 weeks. Mary, it has been a pleasure having you with us today on Main Street. Best wishes.
Thank you very much.
Still to come on Main Street, Dave Thompson and I will look back in this week's news here in North Dakota. Dave, of course, is our veteran news director here at Prairie Public, and we'll look at what has happened in the North Dakota legislature. Also, our veteran movie reviewer, Matt Olean, stops by the Main Street studio. The movie Matt will review this week is Mickey 17, and it will give you a very different idea on what the term expendable really means. That's all ahead on Main Street. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Rick Gion, Major Gifts Manager here at Prairie Public. When you give to Prairie Public, you hear your donation at work. Your generosity helps everyone in the Prairie region have access to programs that educate, involve, and inspire. If you'd like to pay Prairie Public forward in an even more impactful way, I invite you to join our Investor Circle. It's a group of members who care deeply about Prairie Public and who want quality, non-commercial programming and fact-driven news to touch even more people in our communities. Become an Investor Circle member right now with a gift of $1,200 or more annually or at $100 per month. Go to prairiepublic.org/support for more details. And thank you for caring about Prairie Public.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather around, everybody.
It's time to welcome our veteran news director, Dave Thompson, to Main Street. Dave, how are you this week?
I'm doing very well, Craig. How are you?
I'm doing well, Dave. Welcome back to Main Street, of course. And you have been working hard covering the North Dakota legislature. Dave, we always ask you what your biggest surprise has been in the North Dakota legislature this week. What do you have for us?
Well, the biggest surprises I'm hearing would be something to do in the Senate committee regarding the property tax bill. And also, there's some feeling that they still want to keep like 5 or 6 days just in case, you know, something happens with cuts at the federal level and the state might have to come back in a special session to take a look at that. So there's a lot of discussion as we're getting toward what I call the third period of the hockey game, which is the conference committees, that there's still a lot of chess pieces in play. Talk about mixed metaphors, chess and hockey games.
I like both of them, Dave. That's fine. Property tax still has been on our minds. It's been on our minds for a long time, Dave. And now it seems there might be some clarity into how this legislature will deal with the property tax reform question. What can you tell us?
Well, I can tell you that this House Bill 1176, which encompassed a lot of things that Governor Armstrong wants and was introduced by Representative Nathy from Bismarck, It got a due pass out of Senate Finance and Taxation Committee. Well, they thought that might be it. It'll go to the floor. And what it does, it increases the primary residence tax credit from $500 to $1,450 and caps local property tax increases at 3% unless local governments go to voters for permission to raise it further. Well, I found out today from the sponsor, Representative Nathy, who said the bill has been kicked back to that committee for further work. It's apparently not ready to see prime time in the Senate just yet. So this will be interesting to see how that unfolds.
What's the sticking point, Dave? What needs further refinement?
And that seems to be a bit of a head-scratcher about what might need some refinement. There is some talk that there are a couple other property tax bills still alive out there, and maybe they're just going to try this last-ditch effort to combine all of them into one big bill, or maybe do something with the caps, either up or down, and see what's going to happen with that primary residence credit. Is it going to stay at $1,450, or is it going to be something else? So apparently there's some high-level discussions going on. The chairman of that committee said, yeah, this is above my pay grade. Apparently leadership is getting involved in trying to hammer out the final deal.
Well, I know the property tax credit is a big deal, and also the cap is a big deal. Those are the two things that
absolutely
they seem to be zoning in on, but perhaps now there's some wiggle room.
Well, one thing that I have heard, and just, you know, this is just hearsay so far, that there one of the property tax bills talks about further funding for K-12 education coming from a trust fund. And that might be part of this whole discussion, too. It might be a much larger bill than we thought.
Dave, North Dakotans have rallied now for town meetings with the congressional delegation, and about 50 people gathered in your neck of the woods outside the Bismarck offices of North Dakota's congressional delegation to call for their representatives to hold in-person town meetings. Any more news about that, Dave?
Well, I will tell you that this is history. Senator Kramer holds those town hall meetings. He has not got one scheduled yet. Senator Hovind doesn't really do that. He does once in a while, but he hasn't scheduled anything yet. Now, Congressman Fedorchuk has a telephone town hall meeting, which, again, yeah, that's a town hall meeting, but it's not in person. The people who are protesting want this in person because they're getting a little bit perturbed about some of the things they're seeing with the DOGE cuts and how it's going to affect here in North Dakota. I say stay tuned for it. I'm not going to rule out that town hall meetings will happen, but they may happen a little bit later.
They should happen. And the other part of that is there should be civil discussion at these meetings. And our hope certainly...
Absolutely. Civil discussion.
Our hope certainly is that that would happen. Dave, back to the legislature. Appropriators now have adopted spending plans for the remainder of the legislative session.
Well, what happened is Moody's Analytics, which basically does the budget forecasting for the Office of Management and Budget, and S&P Global, which does it for the legislature, they came and made their presentations. Both have agreed on one thing. They believe that the price of oil is going to drop. And if the price of oil is going to drop, that's going to mean less oil taxes to fund such things as the Strategic Investment and Infrastructure Fund. So that they had to get into the House and Senate Appropriation Committees met. They talked about the two forecasts, and they basically split the difference. What it means is about $74 million less. However, Senator Beckedahl says there's going to be an expected turnback of unspent money of $100 million, so that helps the bottom line. They do want to leave Bismarck with some money in the bank that will start the discussions for the upcoming biennium, so they're going to be working pretty hard to make sure they come up with a number that everybody's going to like. So a little bit more work to be done in appropriations.
Dave, kind of a fun bill. The Knife River Flint has now been named North Dakota's state rock. And I was thinking about this, Dave. I can't tell you if my native state of Wyoming has a state rock. I'm going to have to research that.
That's a good question. They talked about it at a Botno grade school, and they have a rock club called the Botno Rock Hounds. And they had some of the teachers were saying, hey, we don't have a state rock. We do have a state fossil. So they came up with some suggestions for state rock, and they voted on the Knife River Flint. And they say there's a lot of history with Knife River Flint in terms of our Native American populations. So they started pushing it, and they got the legislators in their district to write a bill naming the Knife River Flint as a state rock, and it has passed the legislature on its way to the governor's desk.
Dave, I just fired up my quantum nexus 10-core obsidian-minded celestial engine of a computer here, and I let you know that Wyoming has a state gemstone. It's the nephrite jade, but it doesn't have a state rock. So somebody might have to hop in on that in the cowboy state. Dave, let's move along here. What should we look forward to in the legislature next week here in North Dakota?
Well, apart from the discussion about property taxes, they're probably going to hone in on one school choice bill, and I call it school choice. It's about school savings accounts where parents can use that money to, you know, do what they will with it, whether it's going to be for music lessons or maybe for homeschooling or maybe for elementary and secondary education in parochial schools. But there are a couple of competing bills, and they're going to probably come up with one bill that will do that, that the governor would sign.
Dave, about that, as states look at, especially many Western states, look at more private education, are there concerns still that this might impact public school funding somewhere down the road?
And of course there are, and there's really concern among people in Western North Dakota because they don't have private schools they can send their kids to, and they say their schools need some repair or need to be replaced, and they're worried money won't be there for that too. So there's a real tug and pull on this, and we'll have to see how that works itself out too.
Dave Thompson and I talk about the state's news each and every Thursday right here on Main Street. Dave, have a good rest of your week and have a fine weekend too. Are you going to watch any college basketball?
I probably will. I am a fan. But I will be watching college hockey.
Thanks for joining us, Dave.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Josh Beauchet, broker and realtor with Real Broker LLC. With a team of agents serving homebuyers, sellers, and investors throughout North Dakota, the Detroit Lakes area, and northwest Minnesota. Josh can be reached at 701-367-3513.
Hi, I'm Ira Flato. If you love learning things, you're going to feel a sense of awe and wonder when you listen to Science Friday every, you guessed it, Friday evening at 7 Central, 6 Mountain on Prairie Public. Tap into your curiosity and learn something new every week. I can't wait for you to join us.
There's the fanfare we listen to each and every Thursday. It tells us one thing, that our good friend Matt Olean is in the Main Street studio for his weekly movie review. Welcome to Main Street, Matt.
Hi, Craig.
This week's movie is Mickey 17. Let's listen to the trailer.
On Earth, nothing was working out, and I wanted to get the hell out of there.
You're applying to be an expendable?
You read through the paperwork.
Yeah. I should have read through it.
That's it. Mickey, deep breaths. Fill your lungs. Imagine there's an unknown virus in the air.
And you're sucking in every single microscopic particle floating around.
All the viruses.
So good.
There really was an unknown virus in the air. A lethal one.
See you tomorrow.
Fellow pioneers, almost every single one of you will be remembered throughout history.
They made me work my off, one mission after another.
You're an expendable. You're here to be expended.
Every time I died, they just printed me out again. Everyone asked, what's it feel like to die?
All right, Matt, we've heard the trailer. Aren't we all expendable in one way or the other? What did you think of the show?
Not quite like Robert Pattinson is in this, this movie. So this is Bong Joon-ho's first film since Parasite. You know, he famously won a bunch of Oscars that night 5 years ago for an amazing film called Parasite. He's done a few English language films like Snowpiercer, which is also science fiction. This is a science fiction film based on a 2022 sci-fi novel by Edward Ashton. And it's a futuristic film set in 2054, and a lot of people are signing up to go off into space onto this planet. And Robert Pattinson plays this kind of loser who signs up and decides to be an expendable. He doesn't quite read the fine print on the contract. Let's put it that way. And finds that he's basically being used for human research, so his body can be killed. they can do tests on him and research on him, and then basically copy him again for Mickey 2, Mickey 3, Mickey 4, etc. Reprint was the word they used. So that's the premise. Mickey 17, the title, centers around kind of the 17th iteration of him that we see at the beginning of the film, and then there's flashbacks to get to that point. It co-stars Naomi Ackie as kind of his love interest in the film, and some cartoonish performances by Toni Collette and Mark Ruffalo as kind of the heads of this planet who are, you know, doing the research and wanting to eradicate some of the natives on the planet. And the natives, let me just say, without giving too much away, kind of steal the movie, these creatures that are on the planet. I didn't care for this movie very much. I had big expectations going in because it's Bong Joon-ho, but I'm a little hit and miss on his films, even though he, you know, got the Oscar for Parasite. I found it to be a very well-staged, nice production design. The planet looks interesting. The ships look interesting. There's some big actors in this, but it's a curiously cold-hearted enterprise, a little bit soulless. I didn't find much to grab onto from a human aspect here, including Pattinson's character, even though Pattinson, you know, ends up playing like dual roles and is very good in the part. Naomi Ackie is good. Ruffalo, I guess they wanted him to go over the top with his performance, and that's what he clearly does. He chews a lot of scenery. There's been a lot of commentary from people suggesting that his character is based on the current president. Bong Joon-ho has denied that. But again, it's based on a novel, so the source material was a novel from 2022. I just found the film to be too long. It's 2 hours and 17 minutes. There's just not a lot to grasp onto, Craig. There's the human element. You end up really not caring for any of these characters whatsoever. And I always say in movies, something's got to work for you in that movie. It can't just be admiring the production design or this or that. Something has to work on a human level, even if it's a science fiction film. And it really did not work for me. I don't think it's a disaster. We're not talking, this is not a disaster like Kevin Costner's Horizon and American Saga last year. Nothing like that. I do think it's going to have trouble finding an audience. The early box office returns are okay, but not great. It lost out to Novocaine, the film Novocaine, last week at the box office. So I think word of mouth is going to hurt this film a little bit. I was just kind of grasping for what is this film? What's the point? What's the message of the film? I think there is a message to the film, but the characters just did not come to life for me.
Can you tell us what you thought the message was, Matt? I'm wondering, is it economic exploitation? Is it class struggle? Is it thought of how science might become? What were you thinking about?
I think it's a lot of that. I think it doesn't bang you over the head with the message, and I like that Bong Joon-ho doesn't do that. But I think there's something about genocide in there too, with, you know, Mark Ruffalo wanting to wipe out the natives of the planets. There's a couple lines about, well, they were here before we were, you know, and this is, you know, something that's part of our history and part of a lot of countries' history, whether it's Australia or the United States or whoever the history is. So that's definitely in there. I just, you know, this isn't Parasite. If people think he's going to top Parasite, he's, you know, probably going to be directing a long time to top that movie, because that movie, you know, hit all the chords. It was this huge moneymaker, even though it was a foreign language movie. It made tons of money in the U.S. People really liked it. They liked the aspect of this family of swindlers in the movie, if you remember seeing it, Craig. And even though they are kind of a family of swindlers, especially the brother and sister who kind of, you know, ingratiate themselves into that rich family's house, you still kind of cared for them. And this time, it's just not there. You know, he's got a big budget to work with, big stars to work with. I just don't think this is going to be a classic science fiction film. I don't see that happening at all as years go on.
Matt, before we move on, this had to have been a film lathered in CGI. Do you know about that and its background with this film, and did it work for you?
Well, certainly the native creatures on the planet are complete CGI. Computer-generated imagery, right, is what we call it in the business. But most of the film is humans talking, you know, Robert Pattinson, his romance with Naomi Ackie, who's a very good British actress, kind of figuring out what is his role on this planet. You know, the Ruffalo Toni Collette characters become cartoonish at some point. And I guess that was Bong Joon-ho's, you know, he's going for satire. This is a science fiction comedy, which is not a very big genre. Science fiction is a big genre, but science fiction comedies, that's not really a genre. So he's trying to do something here that maybe hasn't really been done on film, and that is to make a funny science fiction film. And I don't think it's terribly funny either in parts. It tries to be, but something just misses on this movie, and it's not a bad movie. It's just not, I don't think it's what it was intended to be, but the CGI is fine. And we you know, that's what's going to happen in a lot of movies. You really have to pay attention in this movie, too, to the dialogue.
Matt, let's turn to the page. You and your colleagues have been working really hard on the Fargo Film Festival, which is now in its third day as this airs here on Main Street. How's it going? And give us a little sense of the work behind the scenes.
Boy, there's a lot of work behind the scenes. This is the 25th year of the festival, so a big anniversary for us. And the volunteers work so hard. There are seven categories of films that people can see: narrative feature, narrative short, documentary feature, documentary short, student, animation, and experimental. And the program's online. You can get tickets at the Fargo Theater, and you know, you can buy tickets for one session or two sessions or how many ever you want. But the crowds that I've seen so far were good. Our opening night crowd for the film Speak, which is a really interesting movie about high schoolers competing in national speech contests, including a Moorhead senior named Sam Schaefer, who's featured in the movie. We had a huge crowd for that Tuesday night. That was really nice to see. And I think the crowds are going to be great all week, and it looks like an amazing week. I have a couple of sessions I'm hosting where I'll have directors up there doing a Q&A with me. I'm on a lunch panel on Saturday, which is kind of about the founding of the festival for those of us that were there at the very beginning. So come on out to the Fargo Theater. Just walk right in and get your tickets.
What's your sense of the Fargo Film Festival today, Matt, looking back on what it was 25 years ago?
We had no idea what we were doing when we started this. It was a three-day event with like 35 movies. Now we screen over 100 movies. And let me say, there's over 300 movies that get submitted every year, but we have to pare those down and put the best ones out there. And directors know that. When they submit to film festivals, there's something called rejection, and it's part of the business. As Hyman Roth said in Godfather 2, Craig, this is the business we chose. And it really is a tough business for these film festival directors and actors and actresses, because these are shorter films sometimes that aren't played at Cineplexes, but they do it out of the love of movies and trying to get that big break.
All right, Matt, let's go to the Oscar trivia part of our segment here on Main Street. Matt, it's baseball season, as you know, and you know that I love the sport, love all things about it. There have been several baseball pictures nominated for Best Picture, but none have ever won. Give me a couple that have been nominated for Best Picture.
Well, Field of Dreams, 1989, probably should have won. That's an amazing movie. That was up for Best Picture, lost to Driving Miss Daisy. Pride of the Yankees, 1942, right, Craig? With
that's correct.
Gary Cooper's Lou Gehrig, who you know only died like a year prior to the making of that movie. Those are two. Are we looking for some more, or are those the two?
One more that I have one on my more. List, Moneyball.
Oh, Moneyball, sure. That's a really good movie. That's an excellent movie.
We've been to the movies with Matt Olean.
This is Bird Note. We often hear it said that spring bursts forth as if winter's leafless trees suddenly shimmer with green. Flowers pop. Birds start singing with all their hearts. But this seasonal change isn't instantaneous. It's a series of waves, slowly breaking waves that sweep up from the south to the north, right over the continent. Early spring migrants like robins and bluebirds return north in March, some even in February. Across the whole of April, week after week, new songbird migrants work north from the tropics, adding bit by bit to spring's ever-growing soundtrack. By May, birds continue flooding into northerly states in Canada. And even as late as June, birds like willow flycatchers and morning warblers are just completing the trek to northern breeding sites from South America. By this time, those early robins may already be hard at work feeding their second brood. For them, spring has been bursting for over 3 months. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for March the 20th. Today's Dakota Datebook is about Charles Alexander Reynolds. Charles was born on this date in 1842 in Illinois. The son of a doctor, Reynolds attended prep school before moving to Kansas with his family at 17. Seeking adventure, he left his family to work as a teamster on a wagon train. A year later, he joined the Union Army to fight in the Civil War. Reynolds was short, stocky, with dark red hair and wide-set blue eyes. He led a clean life and preferred the company of men who shared his interests in geology, animal life, and Native American cultures. This earned him the nickname Lonesome Charlie. After his discharge from the Army in 1864, Reynolds headed west to become a buffalo hunter. By the time he reached the Fort Berthold area, he had gained a reputation as a skilled frontiersman. Native Americans called him White Hunter that never goes out for nothing due to his superior hunting abilities. In 1872, Reynolds was hired to guide the first Yellowstone expedition, escorting Northern Pacific Railroad surveyors. The following year, he joined a second expedition, earning the respect of Custer as a superior scout. Custer later hired him as a chief scout for the Black Hills Expedition in 1873, where Reynolds confirmed the presence of gold and was sent to deliver the news to Fort Laramie. This announcement would ultimately lead to his death. In 1876, Reynolds became a scout for General Alfred Terry's column, which was tasked with bringing in Sitting Bull. He guided the 7th Cavalry toward the Battle of Little Bighorn. Custer sent Reynolds to lead Major Reno's battalion in its attack on the Native American encampments. Reynolds had serious concerns about the cavalry's ability to withstand the battle, and he was right. Reno's troops were soon in retreat. Dr. H.R. Porter, who witnessed Reynolds' death, recalled, "The Indians were shooting at you," Reynolds warned him. Moments later, Reynolds fell, fatally wounded. Reynolds was 34 when he died. His bravery saved Dr. Porter, who was the only 7th Cavalry surgeon to survive. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Mary Helm. I'm Ann Olquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Americans say they're more and more worried about bird flu as the virus has spread to some humans, but new research suggests that defenses built up from past flu seasons may help protect us against bird flu.
While this is a bit of a silver lining, this does not mean that we should all feel like we're safe.
That story on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central, it's The Middle with Jeremy Hobson. Jeremy asks the question, what do you want the future of American energy to look like? We certainly know that's on the mind of former North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum, who now, of course, leads the country's Department of the Interior. At 7 p.m. Central tomorrow, it's Science Friday with Ira Flato. From all of us here at Prairie Public, we hope you have a great North Dakota weekend, and we look forward to seeing you again next week right here on Main Street.